Hello, and welcome to the Midwest Genealogy Center's Tell Me a Story program, an initiative to record America's family history in sound. Oral histories are one of the most personal and rewarding ways to preserve family stories. The Tell Me a Story sessions are 45-minute interviews between two people with the assistance of a trained facilitator. Participants will receive a compact disc with the full interview. A copy will be archived at the Midwest Genealogy Center and, with permission, later made available to the public. And now, another story.
Good morning. This is September 18th, 2015, and I'm at the Mid-Continent Public Library trying to introduce into the family a different archival method of audio recording of my family history, but more importantly, my history, since Pat and I, my first wife, have written a book called The Gene T. and Patsy Sue Rob Waters Family, and it's in several libraries around the country, most importantly, all of them that we thought of particular interest. There were only 27 copies made, and I gave a copy to each one of the grandchildren, but not the children, as there was a limitation there. I knew they had availability of copies, but there is only one copy remaining, and it's for sale for $14,000. I have had no takers. Again, my name is Gene T. Waters, and I'm here just to record a little bit about my life history as I can recollect it chronologically and extemporarily. On the move, so to speak, here. It originated by the fact that we were asked to do this at a family, at a 65th class reunion in Jefferson City last month, and I thought it was pretty neat to record something that had paralleled that particular session, which I thought turned out very well on just a sudden notice to give a little background of what we had done since high school. So I'll pick up at that point in my life, and knowing that there was 18 years prior to that, but in high school, I was not the most intelligent individual walking the streets there, or the most popular. I was that kind of background type person. I had an interest in science, and at that time in my life, age 17, had completed 5 years of research for Harvard University. Most of that, 3 years, was in solar observations, of sunspots daily for over a period, again, of 3 years. That was quite an extensive period of time for a young man. That evolved into and paralleled another study called variable star observing, which I did for 2 years. These were done through the AAVSO, the American Association of Variable Star Observers at Harvard University. My intent was to get into a scientific endeavor, astronomy, and that was my primary thrust in life. Took to that point that early in 1940s, I was elected the first president of the Central Missouri Amateur Astronomers, where we had about 15 fellows from Central Missouri that joined at Morrison Observatory at Central College, Fayette, Missouri. And I went over there like with Mr. Larry Bell for about once a month for a couple of years, and finally reached a point where I was going to graduate from high school and decided that Harvard was the place I wanted to go. I took the entrance exam with fellow students in Columbia in, early 1950, and results of that were devastating. I was not smart enough to get a scholarship to Harvard, and my parents were not in a position to send me to such an illustrious institution. So that being set aside, I was very disappointed I did not get a scholarship to Harvard. But intellectually, I think I could not support that endeavor looking back. But I did have other ideas, having my connection with Central Methodist College Observatory there, that I would just go to college over there and start. So I decided that I would do that, and did go to Central College the fall of 1950. And following high school graduation, all worked well. I settled in at Central College, and as I had done since age 12, was looking for a job, something to do to keep me busy and earn some spending money. So I found my way to what was then a dime store type facility, Manley Brothers Department Store, which is in essence a dime store at that time frame. But anyway, I took a job there as a stock boy. And it wasn't long until I had noticed a young lady in the candy counter section that was a junior in the local high school. And I became interested in her. I'll say it this way, that I discovered a heavenly body. My interest in astronomy was paying off big. And we got acquainted and conversed, unloading boxes and so forth in the store. But I got to know her enough that I wanted to invite her out on a date. But there was a major problem. High school juniors do not date college freshmen. So I had a big thing to get that going. And fortunately, unbeknownst to me, there was a lady working in the dime store, Manley Brothers, that knew Pat's family very well and actually attended church with them every Sunday morning. And again, unbeknownst to me, she put in a good word for me. So a lady, Alberta Striegel, made our life possible by allowing her folks to relent a bit and allow me to date their daughter. Although they preferred that I date her on Sundays, as we visited her grandparents in close to Higbee, Missouri, a little church called Mount Ararat Baptist Church. And we went up there on the weekends and had a chance to eat at Grandma's house and go out in the field, walk around, and get to know each other, fish, and do those sort of things. But in addition to a few dates on during the school year, as I commuted from Central College to her house, one time I remembered my ice skates. It was about a mile and a half down there to her home. So anyway, we slowly worked our way into the family. The family of her parents became more relieved that I wasn't of any harm. So anyway, that developed over a period of time. And to where in the spring of 1951, I became interested enough that we began to plan ahead for some things that we needed to do. And over that year into 1952, obviously got to know each other, interchanging between high school events and college events. And I became aware of, I used my father's car. I could commute back and forth to Jeff City, and which I did. I hitchhiked many times over there, but I could come back on the weekends, and Pat and I would have dates and move around a little more freely in the community and do those things that were not so close to home. That went well, and by the fall of 1951, we had decided maybe that we were meant for each other, and we did develop that until the point that we decided we were going to get married, and we began to make plans of how we were going to do this, and a lot of hurdles to cover there. Our families were of the old school and did not tell us anything about sex. We developed this on our own. I guess these things come naturally, but we would go to the Missouri State Library and we'd check out books secretly, and we could study up on this matter. Again, when as life developed, it was not a problem. But anyway, if things are major hurdles as young folks grow from their late teens. Again, when we met, Pat was 16 and I was 18. Just 2 years later, when she was 18 and I was 20, we were married. So we moved right along. She, after graduating from high school, went to Gem City Business College over in Quincy, Illinois, and with her friend Pat Lincoln at that time. Pat Camp was her maiden name. The two going back and forth each week. Pat Lincoln's boyfriend, Roy Lincoln, and I drove them over there. After they made their way back home on the bus, we drove them back on Sunday evenings, and then made our way back in the early morning hours to our work sites in the summer of 1952. That worked well. Pat got a secretarial diploma over there. This is the same college that my dad had graduated in the early 1910s, somewhere along in there in the banking business. Pat got a secretarial diploma, again, planning ahead for our future. She did in 1952 take a job at Waters Hall, a family member, old family member in the agriculture area, and began working at the University of Missouri. I, in my case, had managed to get through the courses at Central Methodist College and decided to move on to the University of Missouri Columbia, which I did in the fall of 1952. Pat was already there. I found a job in the auditing department after taking several jobs at here and there in Columbia. I did settle in the auditing department under Mr. C.C. Falsmeyer, a very fine fellow, who kind of guided me through the things I needed to do for auditing sorority and fraternity books during that period of time. Time was moving on. I should back up a little bit and say that I gave Pat her engagement ring in February on Valentine's Day of 1952. Her folks thought it might be a little premature to make that public, since many of the teachers in her high school were single ladies, that it might be well to wait for graduation, which we did. I gave her the ring and for Valentine's Day, but we formally announced our wedding plans after graduation from high school, which was set to be in December of 1952. This transpired. I moved from my facility on Hitt Street, and she moved from her home in Fayette, and we were married on December 21st, 1952, for our first apartment, a one-room apartment on Hitt Street, Columbia, Missouri. She commuted every day to her work at Waters Hall. I did my class work and also was a part-time auditor for the University of Missouri. This went great. We finished up our term of study at the University of Missouri. I got my BS degree in accounting with a minor in statistics. And our neighbors, as we moved to Columbia to student housing, was a fellow by the name of Bob. I don't remember his last name, but he made a major change in our life. One of those happenstance encounters. He had served in the United States Coast Guard. Of course, during all these years, I had the draft board looking into my situation continuously. The Korean War was underway, and I was subject to draft, but had been exempted because I was going to college. And I had a chance to enlist in the United States Coast Guard. Being a landlubber from Missouri, they have a little bit different itinerary, but this was a major event in my life. The fact that I entered the United States Coast Guard made a man out of me and changed our whole lives and our future. Bob recommended it, and I did follow through and enlisted in the Coast Guard. The draft board was right behind me. 2 weeks after I enlisted, I got my draft notice, so things were very close there. They ordered me to report to the U.S. Coast Guard Academy in New London, Connecticut, which I did in on August the 10th, 1954. And Pat was at home, and at that time, she's still working at the University of Missouri. She commuted to her a few months after I left, but Pat was pregnant at that time. We had planned her first child in spring of 1954, and Elizabeth Jean Waters did arrive in December, about the same time that I graduated from an officer candidate school in New London. So I was not home when she was born at Boone County Hospital, but did make it home a couple of weeks later on about December 10th. And there we were at Grandma's house, and spent a couple of weeks after graduation. I had been ordered to report to the U.S. Coast Guard facility in Mobile, Alabama, aboard the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Sebago. And I did that. Pat joined me a few weeks later. We rented an apartment at Somerville Court, and second floor with our new daughter, away from home for the first time. Times have changed so much. I can recall Pat saying she used to go to the grocery store, and she'd leave Beth in the buggy out in front of the grocery store when she went in to shop. We had a good life there. Again, our first really life is in an apartment that we were away from our folks, could not return home on the weekends. In our, by the way, 1931 Ford Model A. We paid $75 for it. We commuted back and forth to Jeff City, my folks, and Fayette, her folks from Columbia, about every weekend to do the wash and those things that we needed to do and restock on foodstuffs and those sort of things that folks always help with. And so anyway, we were off on our own. We had gone to Kemp Chevrolet and bought us a 1956 Chevrolet, our brand new car. And we were off to solve the world's problems on our own in Mobile, Alabama, away from home. So anyway, I went aboard ship and as an ensign and was quite taken back by the shipboard routines and being a landlubber, if you will, for all my life to go out to sea in a 255-foot Coast Guard cutter, again, the USCGC Sebago. I went aboard as assistant gunnery officer and probably the person in charge of the ship store, things they could trust me at. I'll make a long story short. Within 1 year, I was operations officer and navigator aboard that ship, and that was probably due to my interest in astronomy. The captain felt comfortable in my navigational ability, so I thought that was a very good progression over a period of less than a year in the responsibility of a 255-foot cutter and 150 men depending on me to guide him through the Gulf of Mexico at that time. We spent a lot of time at Campeche Banks. We outrun several hurricanes during that time, and it was a very interesting life, entirely different. We were ordered, the ship was ordered to go to a refurbishing facility at Curtis Bay, Maryland, in the late fall, early winter of 1955. And we arrived there in 1956, I'll say early. And believe it or not, as we rounded the Key West, Florida, one night after midnight, my orders came in and we were transferred to San Diego, California. Now, Pat, in the meantime, had let the apartment go, thinking we'd be back there and get something better on our return after the 6 weeks or 2 months in Curtis Bay. But now we were ordered to San Diego, California. Pat had driven with our daughter, Beth, and the captain's wife, who was handicapped physically, to Curtis Bay, Maryland. We arrived there, and just a few days later, we were on our way back to Fayette, Missouri, for a short homestay, I think around Christmas time of 1955, and to arrive at, as ordered, in San Diego, early 1956. So we were on our way. I was assigned to a Coast Guard's security unit over there, and entirely different life. We ended up spending 2 years over there of our term. We spent a total of 42 months in the Coast Guard, and that was a very eventful time also. It was the time in between wars, the Korean War and the Vietnam War. We, in effect, fought the war that didn't happen. That was during the period of time during the heights of the Cold War with the Russians, and we as Fort Security units were responsible for making sure that no atomic weapons were entered into the United States. We had complete awareness of all shipping in and out of our area, and we had a group of about six of us young men and in the Fort Security unit there under Captain Seeger. We searched the bilges and all vessels and even down to the fishing boats coming and going to Mexico out of San Diego. That was our part of our responsibility. Anyway, the Cold War was at its heights and missiles were ready, and if we had found something detriment in our searches, we would have had World War III immediately as a result of our endeavors there. This went on for 2 years, and very productive years, I should say. We had another son. We had a son born, Kent, in 1956. And then come a year later, Mark was born in 1957. So we decided it must be in the water and we needed to move on from California. So when that time came that we could get out of the Coast Guard, having served our responsibilities for our country, we decided to go back to Missouri. And I had a job with Collins Radio Company at that time, all set up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. We had shipped all of our furniture and everything, and it was on its way. The day, and I should say that my mom, Hazel Waters, came to San Diego and escorted Pat, Beth, Kent, and Mark back to the Fayette area where they resided as we interim before moving on to Cedar Rapids, Iowa with our family. Everything was all set. They left San Diego using one of the TWA airliners at that time, state-of-the-art, we thought was with the twin tails and all that sort of thing. But anyway, the whole family left and went back to Missouri. I followed along a few weeks later in the family car, our 1956 Chevrolet, and stuffed from top to bottom. Life began to change at that point. On my trip back to Missouri, I was broadsided by a car in Mineola, Kansas, at a single stoplight intersection. He did not stop, and I ended up being in the hospital for a few weeks with a broken neck, and eventually was transferred momentarily, I should say, to Chicago facility. We had health service under the U.S. Something or other, public health service, U.S. public health service. So I went up there for a few weeks, came back to Missouri, and during that time, Pat was also in the hospital. She had, say, an infection of some type. And so we found ourselves out of the service and both of us in the hospital. And would you believe, Collins Radio withdrew their job offer to me during what I call now the Depression of 1958. So there we were without a job, both of us in the hospital, three children, staying with Grandma. And we were looking at the world saying, maybe we should have stayed in the Coast Guard. But nevertheless, we progressed on, and I was determined to get with Collins Radio somehow. I was very impressed and still am impressed with that company, which is now has the title of Rockwell Collins, still centered out of Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Anyway, that's another story. But I did find a job with the Communications Accessories Company, one of their subsidiaries in Lee Summit, Missouri, and was happy to get up there and have an opportunity to go into my chosen field, being a cobbler's fun, into computer work, which I did, which my dad had done for many years. He started in the 1930s when IBM kind of started. He said he never did buy a stock company because he didn't think they were going to make it. But nevertheless, he was in IBM equipment, and I had found an interest in that and took courses at the University of Missouri that led me to the point where I was hired to bring Communications Accessories Company into the computer world. Well, again, the Depression of 58 continued on, and not only I, but the president of the company, a fellow named King, who is now known as part of later as King Radio, due to his adverse opinion of Collins for letting him go. And anyway, both of us were let go at the same time. So there I was without a job only after about 3 months with Communications Accessories Company. Of course, being in Kansas City area, I followed through with that and got a job at Farmland Industries. This time we were living, had a home in Lee Summit, Missouri, on Madison Street, and I was commuting back and forth to Farmland Industries in North Kansas City. And that went on for a while, and I eventually got a job with Great Lakes Pipeline in downtown Kansas City. And that was a step up into a larger computer system, and I got a lot more experience and able to use my what was then called IBM electromechanical equipment, 602As and 402s, 403s, those sort of things. And I had enough experience there that after about a year, the IBM salesman said, you know, Gene, I know of a job that is available at the local gas company. And I said to myself, well, you know, after going through about four jobs after getting out of the Coast Guard, and that maybe I shouldn't do this, but I did. I decided to move to the gas service company, and in 1959 began bringing them into the computer age. They were billing at that time about 650,000 accounts every month. We had electromechanical equipment, the old IBM 650 computer, 402s, 403s again, and I think a step up was a 407 electromechanical printing machine. The good Lord took over, again, I should say, because I feel like all of my endeavors along the way of finding Pat and getting into the Coast Guard, a big change in my life, was all directed by him as I look back. But nevertheless, we did successfully install that system there, and I stayed with them for the next 30 years. After having experienced the Great Depression of 1958, I just settled in with my three kids at that time and moved on. 1966, we had another addition to the family. Eric came along, and we're now a family of four, located in Crestview, Missouri at that time, in a home we rented. And I went through about four jobs during that time after I left service till I got settled in with the gas company. Then we moved over to Waldron Street, which we stayed at, and I still live at now, and selling this month. We moved in 1959. We raised the roof and made a Cape Cod out of the home in 1966 when Eric came along. But anyway, that all worked out well, just planned perfectly, and has been our home ever since. The time that we spent as a family, as you can imagine, I was very busy in maintaining a facility that started off billing 600,000 accounts a month and ended up, when I left, was billing about 800,000 accounts in states of Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, Nebraska. We grew up through our data processing equipment, I'll call it. I guess it's IT today. Anyway, to where we had a very large-scale Sperry Univac system when I left there, and that's another story, too. I was part of middle management, obviously, by that time, and set in for the vice president and secretary of the company in his absence on vacation. But we were acquired by another company in, I'm going to say, 1987, 88, somewhere in there. And, no, I'd be a little earlier than that, 1985. And they, of course, would like to see middle management go away. One of my attributes might be patience, because I did stay there for another 3 years and to age 55 in the year 1988, and they granted us the facility that we could retire early, which was great. And I was at the office the next morning with my papers signed that I was ready to retire at age 55 and move on after spending 3 years of not being wanted in a company. It's going to be very embarrassing and degrading, but I made it. Patience was the word. Okay, we were on our way, 1988. We retired, and I say we. This is Pat and I. This is a joint endeavor. I firmly believe we were one person throughout our lives, and I won't try to truncate our life, but we did raise our family. They all turned out well. We had, at one time, three in college at the same time. One of those dropped out later, but nevertheless, we were able to afford to do that. No student loans or anything. We did what was supposed to be done. We did those things that were required of our community and our church and our extracurricular activities, which getting into Pat's life was the DAR. She was president of the Clay County Archives and did many things on her side. I think maybe she would like to have continued in the business world, but that didn't work out, and she raised her family. Devoting her life to us and her community. And as the children left home, I should back up a bit about the family. We had many good years for practical reasons. We were campers, and we had every type of camper from a tent to a motorhome that we used over the years, early 1960s to when the kids left home, I'm going to say in the early 1980s when Eric finally grew up and went to college and then on to the business world, we visited all four corners of the United States from Niobea, Washington to Chula Vista, California to Key West, Florida to Calais, Maine. We had children in all those places, plus Canada, Labrador, Newfoundland, British Columbia, of course, that part of it. We did not make a trip to Alaska, but we did travel every summer for at least 2 weeks, and we camped all the way. It was a very good time to get together. It worked out well. Getting back to the family, we kind of did our thing. We were members of Northgate Baptist Church. Pat and I both became deacons in the church and were very active, and I am still active in that church. But in 1992, December 30, Pat had a pain in the back of her neck. And we went through the evening with that into the early morning to the point where we said we better go to ER and check out. Pat entered ER and they started the tests, and I was directed to the waiting room where by about 4 o'clock in the morning, a nurse came out and said, "Your wife is not going to make it." Now, this is something we were not ready for at all, but we did spend the next 3 or 4 weeks in ER, ICU, I should say, where at one time I think I counted as many as 17 stanchions around Pat's bed as she lay with only a modesty towel over her with a heart lung machine at the foot of the bed going thump, 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 thump for many days. And again, she did come through it. And this is early 1994. Dr. Borkin, after other physicians had given up on her condition, decided that he could do some bypass surgery, which he did. And that was in spring of 1994. She made it through that. She made it through several more years of chronic, what is called, congestive heart failure. And Pat lived until March the 2nd, 2007, some 13 years after the nurse said she wasn't going to make it. At that time, we were been, of course, in and out of the hospital many times, and she did survive and was a survivalist. But at that time, we didn't make it. And I say we were one. So, on the night of March the 2nd, 2007, with the entire family except two members there at North Kansas City, Kansas City North St. Luke's facility. She was certainly aware of her condition, and we were moved to a room large enough to facilitate the entire family, eating facilities and everything. She was quite, again, lucid all day that day and into the evening. And it's later evening, I'm going to say around 7 or 8 o'clock, in fact, it was 9 p.m., she said she needed to get up to go to the bathroom. And the nurses helped her across the room. And then as she returned, I had just put fresh lotion on her bottom and back to comfort her. And I turned to put the bottle on the shelf again, and she dropped to the floor. And that was the end of what we had so dreadly knew was going to happen. It was imminent, but it did happen in a facility so nice, facilitated by St. Luke's Hospital. She was gone. I asked the nurse, "Can't I give her artificial respiration?" And the nurse turned to me and said, "No, she didn't want you to do that. It's in her directive that I not do that, that nothing exceptional would be done to revive her. So Pat was gone, but she had died in the same bed that she died in. She was born in some 73 years earlier in Fayette, Missouri. The old iron bed was at home, and when Pat's condition got critical and the hospital decided that, what can we do for you? I suggested we go get the old iron bed. And with my kids' help, Mark spearheaded the endeavor with his truck to go home, get the bed, bring it to the hospital, set it up in this special room, and she was completely aware of everything that was happening, and she did pass away, in effect, in her old iron bed that she was born in. That was the end of a great life, nothing to regret. We were one person, as I said. We had an excellent marriage, and nothing serious ever occurred that would take us apart. And we loved our children, and we had her cremated as she wanted and buried in Fayette, Missouri, City Cemetery. We have a nice monument down there with our complete family genealogy on the back of that stone. And I visited her every week for almost 6 years, other than the times that I was away traveling or something special. But every week I went down to visit Pat for 6.5 years. And spring of 2013, after being a single person for 6.5 years, at that time about 5.5 years, I was sitting in my same church pew I always sat in for all that time, and Pat and I sat in all that time also at Northgate Baptist Church. A young lady stood out in the choir. For some unknown reason, I had no reason. I said it was never going to happen, and the preacher cautioned me that the word never was one of the large words, but it did. She caught my eye, and I said, well, she's on my deacon's list. I should have called on her sooner, but being single people is not really convenient to meet and visit with those folks. But I said, all right, I'll invite her to go to McDonald's and we'll have a cup of coffee and we'll get to know each other a little bit better. Well, that was my first date with Faye L. Worries. We were to meet at 9 o'clock, I thought, at the McDonald's in North Antioch, Kansas City North. And I was just about ready to leave at 9:20, and she showed up in her car, and again, it was my misunderstanding. We were to meet at 9:30, but we came that close of not passing ships, you might say, in the dark. But we did meet, and the family church relationship expanded from there. I got to know Faye better. I had known her for about a year. Prior to that, she attended, as I did, religiously, so to speak, at every opening to the church doors. And we kind of grew on each other to the point where we felt comfortable in going out and having, if we will, dates. So being single for 6.5 years now, or thereabouts, we had a situation come up in her extended family. She had a very close friend whose husband died in El Paso, Texas, where Faye had taught school for 27 years prior to returning back to Kansas City area. And I said, Faye, let's just do it. We'll just drive down there and do that. So we had our first opportunity to go together and sleep in the same motel room in separate beds during that trip. And when we got to her friend's house, who had lost her husband, a very small, it was a black family, a very small home. And Barbara Johnson said, well, Faye, you and Gene, you just go in that bedroom there. And Gene, you face the wall, you hear? So that worked out well. I went in the car and got my Again, I had outfitted my car for a single-person camper, so I took my bed and went in there and slept next to Faye on the floor, and maintaining our religious commitments that we not be together until we were married. But during that time, we decided we should get married, and I had obviously we had discussed the matter, but not formally. So this was a big point in my life that on one Sunday in early spring of 1913, I was deacon of the week, and Faye was playing the church piano that Sunday morning, and I decided to pull a surprise. I had, with the audiovisual folks, preempted my plan here and had put on the overhead, Faye, and she was sitting at the piano not knowing what's happening here, what I'm supposed to be doing something else, but everything in the program had stopped. I'd said my prayer. I sat down on the front pew, and this overhead began to say, Faye worries, will you marry me? And this caught her quite by start. And I then stood up next to her by the piano and proposed to her in a formal manner. And I said, Faye, would you marry me? And she said, yes. And I told her I would have gotten down on my knee, but I was afraid I couldn't get back up. At that time, I was 81 years old, and Faye was 67 or 68. I'd have to think about it. There's some years difference between us. I think it was 13 years. And everything grew from there. We were married just a couple months later on May the 12th, 2013. And that went well. Faye had some serious medical situations. She had had mastectomy in 2009 and was suffering from some chronic conditions of health. But the good Lord had put us together, and I felt probably maybe a little, maybe not correct on my part, but I felt the good Lord put me there to take care of Faye, having had a good job with Pat for so many years. And I'll truncate this again by just saying that we had many trips together to her granddaughter's graduation in Maine, to visiting New York City, to all those things that we just shared together, our interest in travel and together to be together. But anyway, in 2014, about this time of year, in fact, November the 2nd, 2014, 1 year ago this month, Faye's cancer came back. Her breast cancer had caught up with her again, and in 13 days, on November 20th, 2014, Faye passed away. I had the opportunity to become one person again with another individual on the face of this earth. I look back at marriage now differently now than I did during those 6.5 years that I lived alone, cherishing, if you will, Pat and her memory, but realizing at that point that marriage is of this earth, as it is in the marriage vows, that until death us do part. And Faye had been divorced for 20-some years, but I had been single for 6.5 years. We found each other. The good Lord put us together, and we had a happy marriage, and I lost her. And now I'm going on 1 year in 2 more days after Faye passed away. And she is buried with her mom in Richmond, Missouri, which we didn't have a lot. We didn't discuss these things. We didn't really have time to think about this. I was thinking I would be the one that would go first, and I was beginning to seriously get all those things arranged for her financially after I was gone. But anyway, she was gone, and she and her mom had a very close relationship. Her mom married a fellow from Arizona here in Missouri in the early 1940s, I would say. Faye was born in 1946. Her dad died in 1949. Her mom decided to return to Missouri, which she did, and became, it was a single mom in the early 1950s, which you can imagine was quite a strenuous time for her trying to raise a daughter and make a living. And her dad was buried in Arizona. Her mom returned to Missouri, and they moved into a house, a dirt floor, two rooms. You know, that was enough. The bathroom facilities were outside, and her grandmother was living with them in a full-size bed. Now you think about that a little bit. Very close quarters for she and her mom. I think they slept together for many years. I found a little door stop one time, or I know where it is now. I buried it with Faye. It said, "Bedmates, Faye L. Worries." Excuse me, Faye L. Crum, her maiden name. She married a fellow named Worries, raised a family of two, and separated from her husband by divorce. Some point in time there, some 20 years she was single. But anyway, this now meant more to me when it said on the back of that little monument, "Bedmates," because she and her mom slept in a three-quarter size bed in a two-room home with grandma in the other room with eating facilities and the entire family in this little two-room home in Richmond, Missouri. Her mom worked hard in everything from babysitting to working in a restaurant to the retirement home, and she made a living for Faye and sent her to Southwest Baptist College here in Missouri, where she graduated with a degree in English. I don't know the year offhand, but she did survive that upbringing. Her mom did eventually get a foundation put under the home. Another room was added with toilet facilities inside, room for the kitchen. And of course, Grandma was gone by that time, and they had room to spread out. But her mom died in the 1970s. I don't know the date offhand, but and buried in Richmond. So when Faye passed away, I felt that it would be better for her to be with her mom. And she was cremated and buried with her mom in Richmond, Missouri, shortly after her death on November 20th, 2014. I have lived as a single person since that time. We moved into Faye's house after we married. We never did get good title to it. She left with a will but did not have a good one because we couldn't find the original signature on any of the copies. So we had Faye's house and my house that I had raised my family in, which I had just sold at this time. And Faye's house would be net to try to figure out how to get title to that, good title, I should say, and move on. The kids are not interested in the home. In fact, the kids are not interested in anything particularly, having divorced themselves from me some 6 months ago, and I'm on their list that they don't speak to. So our owner interaction is to see joint flowers on the on Faye's gravesite in Richmond, Missouri. I know not why that has transpired, but they say people take death in different forms. I do know her son was what she called her prodigal son and did not contact his mom for over 3 years prior to our marriage. So there are some situations there that are more misunderstood than I can understand. So anyway, moving on from there, I find myself now at the point where I'm trying to get resettled in life. I have now, I think, as I mentioned, sold our original home. I've moved into an apartment, I think, at 83. I'm old enough I shouldn't have to mow lawns anymore. So I've given up on that little endeavor. I do find a strain on eating, though. People wonder, how do you keep yourself so slim? I say, you should see the folk. You should see the home, the food at my home. It's not all that great, and it's a good way to maintain your weight is not to eat. So anyway, we're working with that, and I have a very nice apartment now in what they call Linden Square in the middle of Gladstone. I'm there for a year. I may do something else, but right now that's good, and I appreciate, and I know the good Lord has followed me all through my life. taking care of me, and I know he will in the future. I have 4 good kids, 8 great-grandchildren, and now 2 great-grandchildren. So things are moving on. We have a hard time all getting together. We're going to next week have our Thanksgiving dinner together, and I'm sure there's lots of things I've left out of this story, but there's a thing that just come to mind moving on through here at this particular time, and I appreciate the opportunity and the facilities of Mid-Continent Public Library Genealogy Center to allow me to sit down and say these things. I started making some notes this week of what I should say and end up being a book again, another chapter in a book, if you will. I couldn't just make notes and say, this is what I want to talk about. I end up writing it again. And I should bring you up to date on the book. It is here in the library, the Gene T. and Patsy Sue Rob Waters family. It had 26 chapters, 538 pages, 27 copies were printed at home. Took me a year, and they're all out except one. And since that time, these 6 or 8 years or so, I have added 38 new chapters, and it will be disseminated as it was for the cousins on a DVD or a flash drive or some modern technique to record family data. But anyway, I have spent my time writing more, and I suspect it's probably have that again. So it's probably reaching 1,000 pages by now, and it will be produced hopefully on a DVD drive here shortly. And again, I want to thank Mid-Continent Public Library for this facility, a different method of recording my family history, which I've written about everybody else and Pat's family, everybody else there, and we've even got it engraved on a tombstone, but I just want to sit down a little bit and talk to the 22nd century folks and say, hey, this is Grandpa. This is what it's like in my life or world. I think I am not leaving as well as I found it because of the world situation is so bad. But I feel I did my part in serving my country and being a good citizen, doing those things I needed to do for everybody and trying to be honest with everybody along the way. Again, thank you again for this opportunity. And thank you, good Lord, for bringing me this far, allowing me to do the things I needed to do. Amen.